Experts have been puzzled by some ancient tracks left behind by sauropods, a group of gigantic dinosaurs, which includes Brachiosaurus, Diplodocus. That's my favorite. I just like to say that word. Diplodocus, Apatosaurus, and Brontosaurus. These creatures required four massive tree trunk-sized legs to support their enormous bodies. I can relate. Yet, researchers have uncovered fossilized prints that seem to show sauropods walking on only two legs. There are two theories. One, the prints were made in deep water and only two of the sauropods' four legs touched the bottom sediment. Or two, the firmness of the ground allowed only the creature's heavier front legs to leave impressions. The issue remains a paleontological mystery, and you can read more about it in the Highlight Carousel up at coasttocoastam.com. And tonight on Coast, Sunday night into Monday morning, Nick Cook, defense and aerospace journalists, is one of the winners of Bob Bigelow's BICS contest, and he joins George Knapp to discuss his award and the essay he submitted on the survival of human consciousness after death, along with his continued work researching zero gravity and UAPs. In the second half, Bernardo Kastrup is a leader in the modern renaissance of metaphysical idealism, the notion that reality is essentially mental and a contender to replace scientific materialism. He'll discuss his award-winning essay on a case for post-mortem survival based solely on mainstream science, along with his work in analytic idealism. That's George Knapp tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Micah Hank stays with us. He's a very busy man. Micah, you have at least three podcasts that I'm aware of. You got the Micah Hanks program, Middle Theory, the Seven Ages Audio Journal. You've got the new the Debrief. Where do we find all this stuff?
Yes, you can find everything that I do linked there at MicahHanks.com. And I'll point out, of course, although I'm best known probably for the podcasts, writing is my passion, and I'm just one of the contributors. Tim McMillan, MJ Vinayas, Chris Plain, you know, our entire group over there, Christina Gomez. We work hard at thedebrief.org, and if you really want to see the latest about the UAP developments, especially what's going on in Washington right now, that's where you can find it.
Yeah, you've got a story here about newly uncovered NASA reports revealing pilot encounters with UFOs. Well, this is going back to, I guess, March, right?
Yes. Actually, my research into what information NASA has been collecting on UAP goes back even further. You and I may have had a couple of conversations on this program about that years ago because, it first came to my attention that there were some UAP reports that were collected by NASA, but on behalf of the FAA. Now, to explain this and what's going on there, essentially, the FAA has an incident reporting database that at the time of its foundation, it was decided that it might be beneficial for a couple of things to take place. One, that pilots or other aviation professionals could report anonymously so that they wouldn't be encumbered by the fear of litigation and things like that. And that way they would be more likely to actually report potential hazards to aviators. And then the other thing, too, was to have a outside agency, someone other than the FAA, that could manage this database on behalf of the FAA as a, you know, somewhat less interested third party. And so it was decided that NASA would actually maintain what became known as the Aviation Safety Reporting System. And this database, it's publicly searchable. I wrote a book back in 2013 called The Ghost Rockets, which, you know, of course, looked at the historical phenomena that was seen over Scandinavia in 1946. But what I found from combing through the Aviation Safety Reporting System was that there have been a lot of sightings of missile or torpedo-shaped objects over the years. Many pilots have said that they've seen these objects in close proximity to their aircraft. Now, again, my contention would be that many of these objects only bear a superficial resemblance to a missile or a torpedo. In likelihood, their behavior seems to indicate that they're something more akin to drones. We can't rule out in some instances that, you know, pilots may have seen balloons and things like that as well. But there are a number of reports that involve large, you know, objects, sometimes oblong, And something that sort of comes to mind here, I guess, if we go back to the ODNI report from back in June, we will remember, of course, that they say that the collected information that was analyzed by the UAP task force goes all the way back to 2004. Most of it was collected in the last couple of years, but they at least go back to 2004. What that obviously appears to reference is the so-called USS Nimitz incident, where, as we now famously recognize, the UAP observed by Commander David Fravor, Alex Dietrich, and others in that incident, you know, this so-called tic-tac, a tic-tac-shaped object. Again, it bears some resemblance to the kinds of things that I was seeing reports about in the Aviation Safety Reporting System, and which I, in part, I featured a chapter about that in the Ghost Rockets back in 2013. Well, fast forward to the present, because the debrief decided to reinvestigate that collecting system. And in fact, I actually spoke with Ted Rowe of NARCAP, which is a very important organization that looks at pilot reports and pilot incidents involving UAP. And it, of course, actually happens to be the case that NARCAP had worked with the Aviation Safety Reporting System for a time. Richard Haynes, who had been a member of NARCAP, also had actually investigated some cases that had been flagged by the ASRS that were flagged and then information thereafter sent to NARCAP. And they did follow-up investigations on some of these UAP incidents reported by pilots. This is of importance, and I'll tell you why. Really, I think that one of the main things that was outlined in the ODNI report in June was the flight safety issue. And although there is much to be desired, I think, right now, we have to wait and see what comes of the DOD's newly announced group, as we've termed it, versus what was proposed in the Gillibrand Amendment. But, I mean, I do think that flight safety will be important no matter what iteration the government's ongoing UAP investigations take. And, again, what is specifically stated in the new release by the DOD is that the AOIMSG will synchronize efforts across the department and broader U.S. government to detect, identify, and attribute objects of interest in special use airspace and to mitigate any associated threats to safety of flight and national security. So, obviously, safety of flight is preeminent in terms of what this new investigative component will be looking at. Now, really quickly, a criticism that they've offered also is that we need to be looking at all potential threats in all airspace. It seems to be limited with the new group to special use airspace, and that is significant. That's one of the most significant differences here, because by limiting operations to special use airspace, that essentially just means military operating areas, restricted areas, warning areas, prohibited areas, or locations primarily used for military flight operations. But let me tell you, Richard, after digging into the ASRS database, it's very clear that pilots all over are encountering UAP, and they see them pretty frequently.
Let me ask you about NASA. I joked before the break. I forget who was it that coined that term, or that alternate, NASA, never a straight answer. Bill Nelson, director of NASA, I guess it was back in, was it October? He was being interviewed, and he was asked about the possibility that UAPs might be piloted by extraterrestrials. And he, you know, I think he said something like, well, who am I to say that life is, that we're alone in the universe? Or in other words, he held that possibility open. Are we seeing kind of a sea change in the attitude with NASA? Because we often associate NASA with, you know, cutting the feed on the video camera on the International Space Station anytime there's some UAP caught on camera. What are your thoughts about what's happening at NASA regarding UAPs?
Well, it's interesting because, of course, people have alleged for years that NASA knows more than it's letting on about UFOs or UAP, and that they're covering up that information. Now, I think what's pretty obvious, and this is another fundamental point that should be made about the reporting that, you know, I've done and that, you know, many of us actually have contributed to over there at thedebrief.org, really NASA has been collecting information on UAP, and from time to time reports are filed, like in the Aviation Safety Reporting System, which it, you know, maintains on behalf of the FAA, but still I would maintain that's NASA that's doing that work. Are they specifically looking for UAP? No. But they do collect information in a wide, you know, range of different areas, which sometimes also includes UAP. I recall Tim McMillan interviewing a NASA official some time ago who had said to him, look, you know, NASA Earth data, that's made available online. Anybody can go and they can search through that. No doubt if there's stuff that's happening out there in our skies, we're probably logging information about it. So that piqued my interest, and naturally, I actually reached out to a couple of folks at the space program and asked them, you know, how would one go through this information, this data, if it's publicly available? And they have essentially said it's not as easy as one might think, but that doesn't mean that the data isn't there. Now, you mentioned Bill Nelson. I'm a huge Bill Nelson fan because to see a chief, you know, a NASA administrator with his enthusiasm is something we've needed for years, and Bill has that kind of enthusiasm. He also participated in the panel there, Our Future in Space, at the National Cathedral, in the same segment with D&I Haynes. And Bill Nelson has had quite a lot to say about UAP, but right now NASA's official current position is a little ambiguous because the same day that the UAP Task Force report was delivered to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, June 25th, 2021, there was a new fact page that appeared at NASA's website titled Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. It gives a lot of information about everything from techno signatures to, you know, the SETI programs. But at the end, it also has a section titled Does NASA Search for or Study Unidentified Aerial Phenomena? To provide a very short summary, it says everything I've just said. No, it doesn't actively look for UAP, but with all the data collected by NASA, if there are UAP out there, they probably get some information about them. Bill Nelson, on the other hand, seems to have, on more than one occasion, I'll point out, Richard, he seems to have suggested that, you know, NASA does kind of look at UAP and that he has actually directed them to investigate what may be going on. And so I hope that whether in collaboration with the DOD's new unit or any other unit that may come to pass, you know, by work of Congress or anything else, I do hope that NASA will continue to play a significant role in collecting information about UAP, but more importantly, I hope that that information will be accessible, at least some of it, within reason, to the public.
There is now a protocol for Navy pilots to report encounters. What about astronauts? What about someone aboard the International Space Station? Is there a protocol for them to report UAP sightings?
That's a really good question. You know, I'm not aware of any protocol for astronauts in terms of what they would follow. I mean, I think, though, that there would be, for anything that would be deemed a hazard, you know, we see, for instance, I follow the International Space Station blog over there at the NASA website where they provide updates on things. And several times this year there have been incidents aboard the International Space Station, which included orbital objects that were believed to have been on a course for potential collision with the ISS. Unfortunately, it seems that this is probably going to be a more frequent occurrence in the years ahead because of anti-satellite weapons technologies that are being tested. There was one recent test that was very concerning, and in fact, we do a newsletter at The Debrief, which I write, and I covered that in the newsletter, the fact that with satellites being broken up during these weapons tests, one carried out by Russia in recent days that was a bit controversial because of the dispersal of debris, which could pose a threat to future operations in space. You know, the International Space Station astronauts were alerted and you know, told, listen, you know, there may be an incident. It turned out to be nothing, but it was only one of several this year where the ISS astronauts have been told, you know, shelter in place, prepare yourselves because there may be an issue. I would imagine if UAP were observed by the ISS, there may be similar protocols to that, where they would be required to notify mission control about what they are observing. Probably they would be equipped with cameras. I mean, we know that they're, of course, equipped with cameras and what have you, that would allow them to document this. What would happen with the information thereafter? That's a good question, but I would certainly be interested in knowing if we're going to see further updates in terms of methods, policies, procedure for how astronauts should respond to UAP. And really, again, with the institution of the United States Space Force, I would think that that would be even more important as we see our military now, of course, stepping into the final frontier, so to speak.
As we approach the bottom of the hour, I want to start this conversation and pick it up on the other side, and we'll also open up the phone lines and take questions and comments for Micah Hanks, but I wanted to ask you about your recent trip. I guess it's been a couple of months now since you went to Brazil. Tell me about your mission there. What were you hoping to find and research?
You know, Brazil is such a wonderful country. I, in fact, hope to go back early next year. And, of course, I'm going down there for everything from the food, the culture. I'm also studying Portuguese. But Brazil has a rich history of UAP and observations and incidents involving UAP. Actually, several rather compelling photographs, you know, that have been collected over the years. And certainly while I was down there, I traveled into a UNESCO World Heritage site, a national park called Chapada dos Veadeiros, which has quite a tradition also of UAP sightings as well.
All right. And we have a couple minutes here. Can you tell us about the strange lights that you discovered in that area?
Certainly.
I think we've got enough
time to get into a little bit of that. You know, I'll tell you this. I flew into Brasilia, you know, the federal capital, and, you know, my company and I, we leapt into a pair of rented vehicles, and we are traveling. You have to drive about 3 hours out into the country. Our destination was a little town called Alto Paraíso, and the Chapada dos Veadeiros is beautiful. Really, I think many people probably think of jungles, you know, lush green jungles, and there certainly are a lot of, you know, lush green forests, especially around the beautiful waterfalls, but the actual lay of the land is much more like the African savanna in this area. It's quite arid. We saw a lot of wildfires. That wasn't the only light that we saw, though, because as we were traveling along well after dark, we, Rafaela Krasinski, one of my traveling companions in the front seat right in front of me, Hafa and I were looking out the window in the passenger side, and we observed a small blue light out in the distance traveling along. She had been observing it for several seconds. About the time that I actually saw it come into view, we both kind of exclaimed, what's that? And then it blanked out. Richard, I'll tell you, I've observed a lot of satellites entering Earth's shadow and know how easily orbital debris and satellites and other things in space can reflect sunlight shortly after sundown and often produce very vivid lights. This was a little unlike everything I've seen over the years as an avid sky watcher. I can't rule out those more prosaic explanations, but what I do know is that there is quite a tradition of strange lights in the sky seen around Chapada dos Veadeiros, and there are some interesting theories about what might actually cause those manifestations. Are these UFOs in the sense of what, you know, again, the DOD is now officially investigating again, what the UAP Task Force has been reporting to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence about, or are these another kind of UAP, something maybe of the natural variety? And I tend to gravitate toward the latter, but that's still a kind of UAP that I think warrants investigation. And the government has actually discussed in various instances in the past as well.
What are the locals saying about the lights there?
You know, I have spoken to a few of, and I have to, again, credit Dr. Krasinski and some of my other wonderful traveling companions. Being very new to Portuguese myself, they were able to translate some of the stories that, you know, for instance, one of our guides that took us into Chapada dos Veadeiros related this story about having been followed home one evening. He'd been driving in a pickup truck near Alto Paraíso, and he said, and this was very interesting to us in light of what we had seen on our way into the Chapada, he said a large blue light followed him down the highway. He said it was obviously an aerial object, but that it kind of came down and followed him as he drove along one night. Now, he didn't offer any kind of speculations about what the object might have been, but he certainly described it as being a interesting experience. And after
all right, Micah, I got to, pardon the interruption, Micah. I got to jump in. We'll pick this story up on the other side. Micah Hanks stays with us along with your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. When it comes to telling when someone is lying, we currently have very few options, but a team of Israeli researchers claims to have come up with something better than anything we've seen before, using stickers printed on soft surfaces containing electrodes that monitor and measure the activity of muscles and nerves. A team of researchers led by Professor Dino Levy from Tel Aviv University discovered that some people inadvertently or involuntarily rather activate muscles in their cheeks and eyebrows when they lie. No sensors had been able to measure these subtle muscle contractions before, but the innovative ones invented by Professor Yael Hanin and sold by Israeli company Extrodes proved sensitive enough. Tests revealed a 73% success rate of lie identification, better than any existing technology. And you can read more about it in the In the News section up at coasttocoastam.com. Now, if you are an aspiring musician and you want your music heard, what better platform than the millions of listeners available to you right here on Coast to Coast? And on the first Sunday of every month, George Norrie will play bumper music selections from emerging artists just like you who might not be heard elsewhere. You can make your music submissions via a digital thumb drive, and you can send your submission along with an authorization note. Make sure you write a little note giving Coast to Coast permission to play your song, and then you can submit your song digitally, again, on a thumb drive to Tom Danheiser at Premier Radio Networks, 15260 Ventura Boulevard, 15260 Ventura Boulevard, 5th floor, Sherman Oaks, California, 91403, or just go to coasttocoastam.com and go to the highlight carousel. And I believe it's the last slide in the highlight carousel. All the information there about New Music Sundays. All right, we're going to keep this conversation going with Micah Hanks, plus your calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. We're back with Micah Hanks, MicahHanks.com, and you can go there and find the podcasts and the debrief. We're talking about your recent trip to Brazil and Chapada dos Veados. A lot of people go to the jungles of Brazil, kind of a pilgrimage to try ayahuasca. Is that something you're curious about?
Yes, Richard, it is, and you know me all too well. I haven't done that in the future. I certainly would like to, and I'll tell you, someone very interesting who has and who I've spoken to about that a bit is John Alexander. John actually joined me on my podcast, and again, all those podcasts are right there at MicahHanks.com. I'll also point out briefly that you can contact me via email there at my website, too, if anyone has UFO sightings, reports, or information they'd like to share. I always welcome all of that. But John had actually discussed that with me on the telephone, and prior to heading down to Brazil, he said, look, let me just tell you, that's not a ride in the park. A walk in the park. You need to be aware when you go down there if you decide to do that. But he did, and a lot of people have done ayahuasca because of the introspective and spiritual effects that it has. Many people do it for different reasons, but I like to think of it as, and I think this was an expression coined by Dr. Rich Strassman, inner paths to outer space. That's a good way to describe it. So that's, again, a fascinating aspect of the culture, not just in South America, but really through the use of entheogens by different groups and cultures throughout the world.
Well, further to Strassman's quote there, I've seen pictures, paintings from people that have experienced, the psychedelic trip from ayahuasca, and in a number of these paintings, actually a good number of them, there seems to be kind of an extraterrestrial UAP motif. A lot of these paintings contain images of what appear to be flying discs and extraterrestrials. What do you think the connection is between ayahuasca and UAPs and ETs?
This side of the conversation approaches an area where, I mean, it's at the limits of what science can understand, and I often tell people that I have to kind of operate on different partitions. There's the nuts and bolts UFOs could be, vehicles from another world partition, on the hard, all on the same hard drive, but then there's the consciousness side of things. Jacques Vallée, of course, spent years looking at the possibility that UAP may represent something entirely different from extraterrestrial visitation, and that the so-called space visitors motif is just simply the best way that the human mind can reconcile with the phenomena, whatever it actually is. And I'll point out, somewhat less popular though that approach to studying UAP may be, that is still a valid observation. We don't know. We have not yet concluded what these things are, so far as I know. If that were the case, people always say, well, maybe the government knows more than they're letting on. That certainly could be the case, but if we take them at their word, and when we hear them say, we don't know what these things are, the establishment of new offices to investigate them would seem to entail that they're still trying to figure it out also. But now, coming back to the appearances of flying saucers and alien-type things in the visionary art of those who have experienced entheogens and altered states of consciousness, again, very much in line with what Vallée has proposed, it very well could be that the phenomenon or aspects of it are somewhat reliant on human interpretation. In fact, inevitably that's the case. And it has interested me that there are aspects of what people report in their, what appear to be, you know, awake and aware, flesh and blood reality type experiences where they have been confronted with phenomenon that they can't explain. Sometimes this involves aerial objects. Sometimes this also involves the purported occupants. There are some continuities between those experiences that are present in the UFO literature and what the so-called psychonauts describe. Again, we mentioned Rick Strassman in an interview he gave a number of years ago. He tells this fascinating story about spending time with Terence McKenna, author of Food of the Gods, and again, truly a visionary in that area of research. And they had done DMT together. Strassman had done it with Terence McKenna. And Strassman had described entering the altered state and seeing what he said looked like classic little gray aliens that were saying to him, now you see, now you see. Now, again, I would really say that we have to draw a line between saying, well, he saw actual extraterrestrials like those which occupy UFOs, and, oh, well, he had a visionary experience where he saw something similar to that. I mean, I think he would draw that distinction. But it is interesting that there appears to be a continuity there, and it really leaves, I guess, open the question, how much of the UAP experience really is reliant on, you know, archetypes and the human experience of encountering the unknown and then the layers that we project onto it of interpretation, which involve myth and religion and culture and a lot of vestiges of human experience that go back centuries, thousands of years, in fact.
You mentioned psychonauts. Would you consider yourself a psychonaut, with or without the assistance of DMT?
Right, because, you know, I'm not a user. But again, like I mentioned, you know, in the future, I would love to do as John Alexander and many others have done, and you know, explore that avenue a bit more. But I'm also interested. In fact, I wrote a book, Magic Mysticism: The Molecule, that looks at different ways that humans throughout time have essentially used altered states of consciousness to explore the inner space. And one consistent feature from those experiences that we find is that people throughout time have claimed to have had interactions with non-human intelligences. Now, throughout religious experiences, you know, that are described in religious texts throughout time, usually angels, sometimes demons, you know, there are a lot of different interpretations and different kinds of agencies ascribed to these things. In modern times, a modern technological society would probably be more likely to ascribe a sort of intelligence to those like extraterrestrial intelligence rather than gods, angels, you know, deities and things. But there have been many practitioners of mystical arts, meditation, ecstatic body postures and things along these lines who have claimed that they have been able to access altered states of consciousness, no entheogens or substances needed. I've certainly experimented a lot with meditation, Richard, and I think that, you know, however you use it, whether it's merely to quiet your mind and to be able to gain control of your mind so that you can be better equipped for living, or if you are exploring those more esoteric areas, yeah, I think that you can be a quote-unquote psychonaut, maybe without having to rely on the induced experience that entheogens like DMT or psilocybin or something might provide. But I do find those experiences fascinating. And again, being a student of that subject and having read much of the literature, including Dr. Strassman's book, DMT, the Spirit Molecule, what drew me to that, Richard, had been the description of some of the participants in his DEA-approved study back in the 1990s, where they described waking up in technological environments where there were beings. And I'm not the only researcher who has noted the similarity between what some of those experiencers described and the popular claims of so-called alien abductions. And it does make you wonder, is there at times sometimes a continuity between those kinds of experiences? I don't have the answer to that, but the similarities are quite striking.
So do you think it's possible then that people that have these paranormal or supernatural experiences, whether it's an alien abduction, whether it is some sort of close encounter, whether it is perhaps an out-of-body experience, that it might be related to maybe their body's ability to release DMT in larger quantities than than normal?
You know, again, speculating, that's a possibility. I corresponded with Dr. Strassman a number of years ago, and I asked about the idea because some of his participants had claimed that by meditating, they had achieved similar, almost kaleidoscopic visionary experiences. And one of the participants in his study had said that when he was administered during the clinical trial, the study that they had been doing there, I believe at the University of Arizona in the 1990s, when he was administered the same amount of dimethyltryptamine that other participants had received and would have their visionary experiences, it didn't have any effect on him. What was unique about him was that he had said he had achieved a similar state through meditation previously. And so Dr. Strassman had told me in correspondence that one speculative mode through which this sort of state of mind, this altered state, could be achieved might involve a sort of what he termed as an endogenous release of DMT within the, because keep in mind, I mean, it is produced in our bodies. Many living organisms, plants especially, produce it, but humans, you know, there are levels of DMT that can be found in the human bloodstream at any time. Some studies seem to indicate that there is a bit of a jump in the levels around the time of death. And so Strassman had been thinking that perhaps some of the visionary experiences that people on their deathbed, you know, claim to have, that might actually be the influence of DMT released into the bloodstream via a sort of endogenous release, but that there are other ways that that might be accessible to a person throughout their life, and meditation, ecstatic body postures, yoga, and things like this possibly being some of those. And again, this isn't nonsense. I mean, there's a lot of pharmacological literature and other literature in medical science that talks about the presence of DMT in not only our bodies, but also in various organisms, especially plants, and hence why, shaman in South America have used plants to be able to induce that experience and have these visionary experiences. So I do find all of that very interesting. Do I think, however, that there's a connection there with UFOs? Again, if we follow what Strassman speculated about, the idea that there might be things that could trigger an endogenous release of DMT, another theory that I had entertained, and this is entirely theoretical, let me just put that out there, but in Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, I looked at some instances where people who had been in close proximity to extreme electricity, you know, high-yield electromagnetic fields and things like this, often would have very similar experiences to those who were under the influence of psychedelic entheogens. And I had wondered, again, when we think about the idea of electromagnetic spacecraft, UAP, that appear to be capable of flight in ways that we don't understand. They don't certainly don't appear to be propelled by the same kinds of things that our advanced jet aircraft and stealth aircraft are propelled by. If we look at the AT-FLIR targeting pod and the footage obtained by the Navy pilots in the three now famous Navy videos, there's no clear evidence of a propulsion system. And so one theoretical model for how these craft are propelled involves electromagnetic spacecraft, you know, basically electric spacecraft of some kind, possibly nuclear propulsion, or some combination of these advanced propulsion characteristics. But again, a speculation that I've had is that if these aircraft, by virtue of their operation, produce very large yields of electromagnetic energy, and a person in close proximity to that, if they observe a UAP close by, if they are exposed to those electromagnetic fields, could that induce an altered state of consciousness, and could that account for some of the experiences of some of the UAP observers over the years? It's certainly possible. And I'm intrigued by that, because I don't think that we should rule out the claims of those who say that they have actually had experiences with the occupants. In fact, I think that as we move forward into the future of UAP studies, it may in fact be vital that we go back and we revisit the literature and we look at those who say that they have had firsthand experiences observing, either at a distance or up close and personal, with the occupants of these craft, because if they appear to be under intelligent control, and if they appear to be a technology, I mean, it seems logical to conclude, therefore, that there must be a, you know, creator and thereby also operators of this technology. And we shouldn't rule out those accounts that seem to describe observations and encounters with them. But there may be other things going on there, too. And so I've certainly looked at the altered state angle with relation to that.
You know, in the years that I've known you, Mike, I don't think I've ever asked you, have you had an encounter?
As far as UAP encounters, you know, I think that probably one of the only ones that really comes to mind involves the sighting there at Chapada dos Veadeiros, which is interesting because there is a tradition of sightings of UAP in that area. Now, to touch on that briefly, again, I have for a long time studied phenomena, earth-light phenomena, what you might call earthquake lights or natural plasmas, that have been observed down around Brown Mountain, North Carolina. That's something I've spent a long time studying because really it's kind of the proximity aspect. Brown Mountain, North Carolina, which is very close to the Linville Gorge, it's only about an hour from where I live in Asheville, North Carolina. But what struck me about Chapada dos Veadeiros is that there's a lot of quartz there. Geologically, it's very similar to the Brown Mountain and Linville Gorge area. In fact, when I went there, and saw the beautiful waterfalls, the mountains, you know, the stone outcrops. That's exactly what it reminded me of, being in Brazil and so far away from home, yet it seems so familiar. And so I wondered if indeed some of the lights that are observed there are natural plasmas, the likes of which, by the way, when the UK Air Defense Region released their report back in, I believe, 2000 on unidentified aerial phenomena, the so-called Project Condyne. This was another UK government study that looked at UAP and did determine that they exist. Their conclusion was that they thought that natural plasmas like this are probably what constitutes these UAP reports.
Fantastic. All right, MicahHanks.com, MicahHanks.com, and TheDebrief.org. Micah, always a great pleasure hanging out with you. Thank you so much for this.
Certainly. Happy holidays, Richard. Let's do it again soon.
Absolutely. Micah Hanks, MicahHanks.com. All right. That's it for me. For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyon, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Chris Burrows, Michael Cozio, Adam Thompson. Hey, great job, Adam. Welcome aboard. Donna Walker and Sean Latasore. I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. I'll speak with you next December 17th and 18th. Until then, so long for now.